I think, change in the market in the suburbs is the ethnic diversification of suburban households. Racial minorities now make up more than a quarter of the suburban population. Not that huge an increase, but it's up from 19% in 1990, and it's certainly one that is expected to continue to grow. Many new immigrants now no longer, the traditional trajectory of immigrants coming into central cities, many are not, they're bypassing the central cities, they're going straight out to the first-ring suburbs. That central cities have been gentrifying, the affordable housing is now out in the suburbs. And there have been several surveys, one in particular, a 2004 survey that was conducted for Smart Growth America and by the National Association of Realtors, found that African Americans were more than three times as likely to pick a smart growth community over what was characterized as the sprawl choice. The survey phrased things was in terms of trade-offs. And they were asking, would you take a smaller lot but with a shorter commute over a larger lot with a longer commute? And they gave more specificity in those kinds of questions. But they asked a whole lot of these just sort of trade-offs. If you could live within 10-minute walk of, house shops and things, would you be willing to trade that off for better things? And they found African Americans more than three times as likely to pick the smart growth choice, 78% of the time. Over Caucasians. Hispanics chose the smart growth choice 57% of the time, and Caucasians were split 50-50. So all of this interest in more urban lifestyle within suburban context is also prompting increasing numbers of retrofits of office parks and industrial parks into mixed-use neighborhoods. Out-of-date office buildings are just as prevalent as out-of-date retail. And they tend to be a little better built, and they tend to be ready for renovation of the buildings themselves, but redevelopment of their parking lots, because they've got big old parking lots around them. And they're beginning to attract new mixes of residential, neighborhood retail, and educational facilities into their mixes. This one I'm quite fascinated by. This is a late 60s, office park outside of Washington in Hyattsville, Maryland. The original buildings were designed by Edward Durrell Stone, and they each look like a little mini Kennedy Center. Not mini, these are 10-story buildings. But they're getting infilled with a new Main Street, and new retail, a lot of retail frontage. So you can kind of see here, the four original buildings. This is the main arterial road. They're putting in a new Main Street. This is a new high rise that's going in, a new Cinemaplex, grocery store, and they've got a lot of underground parking, some wrapped at deck, but they've actually got some topography that they're able to really use for underground parking. And it's a very interesting project, and this just sort of shows some. You can see the sort of stacking of the uses and the changes over time. This is another project in suburban Maryland outside DC, another office park retrofit. And this one, sort of technology corridor, that Maryland's version of the technology corridor, like 280. This is King Farm, which is a Tortugalis new urbanist project that has won several awards. And this is a new light rail that is proposed to come in, so extending from within King Farm over to this office park that sits right at a major highway intersection. And so here's this little office park. At the moment, only two buildings. There was a third. This one's been demolished. So now there's two buildings here. They're proposing a big. It's both a sound wall, but also will become wind turbine wall at the highway interchange, and then mixed uses around it. And it's also one of the first buildings that's being proposed. They're going to take one of the existing office buildings and convert it to residential lofts. Which in the suburbs makes perfect sense. We see it all over in downtown. I haven't found that many examples of the suburbs yet, but I think it speaks to, again, the market for the creative class, you know, loft living in the suburbs. It's coming, why not? So here's the before and the after. This green roof, and this project is going ahead. This one I'm showing just as an example of, again, an office building converted to very chic, trendy loft. This is in Minnetonka, in Minnesota. And you can see here's the suburban office building, and now the redeveloped, it fits really a very much a sort of office park environment, redeveloped into Cloud 9 Sky Flats. New mixed-use development is also going into industrial parks, like this one on Boston's Route 128. I mean, especially since the dot-com bust, we're seeing a lot of this kind of retrofit happening, especially along these sort of high-tech corridors where land values tend to be high, and it just, you know, doesn't make sense to just have the parking lots anymore. So this one is extremely well located, Route 95, Route 128, and train connection. So it's got actually a transit stop going right into Boston, and it's a new mixed-use development from being a new TOD going in from an old industrial park. Parking rides are getting converted. This was beautifully integrated one, showing this here. Into its existing context by Tori Gallis, creating new public spaces on what was the big parking lot site, parking lots for the parking ride. What's especially cool about when you redevelop a parking ride like this is that not only is the immediate neighborhood now really getting a substantial town center, some substantial economic development, but the whole transit system is becoming made more efficient when the ends of the line are no longer only bedroom communities, and so that everybody's always going in one direction one time a day. Now that's becoming a destination and a workplace. So you've got people using the transit system in both directions at both times a day, you know, at all times a day, and that's, you know, which is just a great help. These are some of the before and afters, that at least the proposed afters, but for this particular park and ride retrofit, Twin Brook Commons. And, oh, there's lots of these. This one's going for a lead MD in the pilot phase. I'm waiting, curious to see. I don't know that much about it. This is one of the growing number, there aren't very many yet, the growing number of cases where developers are buying up entire residential subdivisions to begin to redevelop them. In this case, because it's right next to a transit stop in Vienna, Virginia. So they're buying up a residential subdivision, in this case of 65 homes, but to turn it into a transit-oriented development with 2,500 residences, because it's right on the transit stop. And in the North Virginia market, there's just no question that this is very, very much needed. The example, even in Atlanta, there's actually a subdivision recently that is putting itself on the market. All 85 homeowners recognize that they're in Sandy Springs. Developers have been knocking on individuals' doors, and they decided to actually self-organize and set their own price. And there are growing numbers of examples of these. Garden apartments are also kind of the easy pickings for developers right now. Lots of examples of garden apartment complexes that are getting redeveloped into denser, more urban formats. This particular one out in Indiana, Gramercy, is actually a garden apartment complex built around a golf course. And I showed it because it's also another one of the trends we're seeing. I could name about five golf course communities where the golf course is now being infilled, where it's just, you know, the land has become more valuable. And golf courses actually, it turns out they have a lifespan, and there's a certain point when the golf course can no longer really be maintained very well. Most of the examples of garden apartment retrofits are examples where it's going from places that were basically built for sort of the swinging singles out in the suburbs, in the South, certainly part of white flight generally, and that those apartments now, they're 20, 30 years old, they were very auto dependent, and they're basically being replaced now with more upscale, but denser townhomes. This is one of the few examples that's actually going a slightly different direction. This was also very much a swinging singles apartment complex, the Windjammer, right down near the Hartsfield Airport, famous amongst the pilots and stewardesses. Oh, the Windjammer. They all sort of, oh yeah, we know about that place. But it's now it was entirely studio apartments and one bedrooms, and it's been completely gutted and turned into three bedroom units to accommodate day laborers and infant large immigrant extended families. So one of the examples sort of go again of now how the suburbs are becoming a place where the immigrants are more likely to go. Big box and strip malls are also changing. Here's some strip malls that have been turned into schools in particular. There's a lot of examples. Going to high schools or elementary schools, a lot of Kmarts have been turned into elementary schools. I know of a firm in Atlanta that their entire business, well, not entire, but almost all, most of their business is turning dead Walmarts into mega churches. I'm not sure if that's really more sustainable or not, but it's always interesting. One of my favorite examples is a Kroger grocery store that's been turned into a women's health clinic, and they put the MRI machines in the frozen food section because it already had the voltage, and then the out parcels became medical office buildings, and it's actually now they're coming in and actually putting in housing, and it's just really interesting. You know, but at all scales, this stuff is happening. So here's a list of some of the tools that I think new urbanists have begun to use successfully at the scale of these kinds of individual projects that I've been showing. Number one, using public spaces to distinguish projects and build communities. Using liner buildings to meet the streets, improve walkability, and frame public space. Adding density to older, underparked sites. Selling roof rights, which actually an example here that I'm showing, is a Safeway store where Safeway owns the land. Safeway was going to build their store, and the architect actually said, well, how'd you like to make $1 million? If the land values are at least $1 million an acre, you've got an acre-sized roof. I know a developer who'll build housing on top of your roof. I'm designing your building. The HVAC system will be a little more complicated, but not much, you know, and you get $1 million. And Safeway's built it. And they're doing a lot of, this firm, Sienna Architecture Company, is doing this regularly, the selling of roof rights to mainstream retailers. Rezoning, we know, is an important tool. TIFs, certainly important, location-efficient mortgages. Health impact assessments, I think, are a new tool that we're going to see more and more of. The CDC, Centers for Disease Control, and others have been really developing, just like we do environmental impact assessments on really large projects. There are now tools out there to do a health impact assessment to see if we're increasing the walkability, what's going to be the impact on public health in terms of physical activity? If we're increasing the street network, we're narrowing the streets, what's going to be the impact in terms of reduced accident rates? With all of these various kinds of health impacts and things. But all of these tools really operate principally at the level of the individual project, and they don't answer the question of the bigger challenge, which is how do we really connect the dots? I mean, this is one of the classic new urbanist diagrams. They're saying, you know, well, we've got the lower part of the diagram kind of shows the more typical condition of what we've got nowadays of, you know, a street-gridded city surrounded by more suburban dendritic forms of street patterns. But if we want to get to a point where we have more protected land and then, you know, neighborhoods in course, and the reality is, you know, at best, all we're going to be able to do is overlay the top on top of the bottom. We don't have a mechanism. It's not as if that existing suburban context is going to go away. It's there. And I don't think we've actually, within the Congress, dealt quite adequately with really trying to imagine how do we overlay these two systems rather than just work at that level of kind of the ideal diagram. But what I was actually talking at lunch, but I wasn't able to get the diagrams off of the PDF into the PowerPoint. Steve Salmano has just shown me how to do that on the Mac. I couldn't do it last night. Because one of the diagrams that my partner and I have been doing are looking at those certain markets, especially Denver and D.C., have really been doing a lot more retrofits than a lot of other markets. And so we've been mapping now, so where are they going? Where do you see the new transit? What are the patterns that are emerging? And we're beginning to see the inference of a sort of incremental regionalism. It is very much a sort of graph. It's coming up out from the market, and it's coming up from where the opportunities lie, but there still are patterns, and there still are roles, I mean, for public planning agencies, and for all of us as designers, to recognize and think about how do we facilitate these kinds of changes. Certainly attention to corridors, and we saw some great attention to corridor projects this morning. How do we begin to transform, the investment in, if you begin to change the character of the corridor itself, can you actually get housing to come back onto some of the corridors, and that is a really important way, to address affordable housing and accommodate more people. Trying to get mixed-use nodes at the critical intersections along the corridors, at the intersections are really important. This is a great example. As far as I know, this is the first built boulevard, conversion of a commercial strip into a boulevard in the U.S. in Cathedral City by Friedman, Tung, and Bottomley, as planners. It had been just a commercial strip, but it actually had been the main street of Cathedral City. Cathedral City is sort of a poor sister to Palm Springs. And when the highway wanted to widen, the highway department, DOT wanted to widen it, they kind of screamed and said, you did that once to us and you killed our main street. Now you want to do it again and just kill the teeny little bit that's left. So they actually convinced them to do a throughway boulevard, and they built their city hall on it. It's only 4 blocks long, right where it passes sort of through the center of town. But it's really quite an interesting project. Arlington County in Virginia, amazing transformations along their corridors through TODs integrated with transit. Arlington is now also continuing. Columbia Pike is another. They're using form-based codes as the vehicle for really trying to trigger more redevelopment along their corridors. And a great example in Atlanta that is underway right now, and I'm especially proud because it started as a thesis project at Georgia Tech. And you just love it when you see your students actually make it happen. This project's called the Beltline, and what the students recognized was that you could make a 22-mile loop out of unused, abandoned railroad corridors. And this, if you know Atlanta, this is sort of halfway between the perimeter highway, and then this sort of fits right in between. So it's a 22-mile loop, and he proposed it principally as a transit line. It also connects up several parks, and it's now being planned to be both a park system and a transit system, and it links up about 5,000 acres of underused industrial land. And so the developers are all extremely excited about this at a moment when the in-town living is extremely hot, very hot market. But what's also really interesting is this one, instead of almost all the corridor kind of connect-the-dot projects, are you looking at using existing right-of-ways, existing corridors. This one's using existing right-of-ways, but a rail line, abandoned rail line. And what's interesting is that the neighborhoods traditionally have always backed onto the rail line. And now it offers the opportunity to suddenly introduce spaces that will allow for fronts and more interconnectivity. So that it's being sold to the city as providing interconnectivity along the route, but in fact, I think what's going to be even more has a greater impact overall connectivity is the fact that it's been introduced more connections across and neighborhoods that will link to each other that right now have always been divided by the railroad. So it's a pretty cool project. Changing zoning codes is a big deal. Boulder is a great place. But 10 years ago, they changed their zoning code for a lot of their more suburban areas. And you drive along now, and it's pretty, or walk along, bike along, you get new buildings that are right up at the edge of the sidewalk, right next to properties that are set back. But you can see that transformation as it's happening kind of incrementally in Boulder. And I'll close with this one just because it's such a great, this is the comedy at the end. This is on a cul-de-sac. Here's in LA. Here's a cul-de-sac. And a cul-de-sac, of course, makes wedge-shaped lots. Well, the guy in this house happens to be a wiffle ball enthusiast, a serious wiffle ball enthusiast. So he talks his neighbor into going in on him to develop the wedge between their houses to infill with a professional wiffle ball court. And, so it's just surprising sometimes the opportunities for infill, that we can find in these things. So, in the end now, are retrofits really urbanizing suburbia? Yes, I think they are, but it is a hybrid form of urbanity. It is not a question of simply taking what we think of as, it's not taking downtown Chicago completely changing over things. It's recognizing that the population is not as diverse in the suburbs as it is in the cities, but it's also not as family centered as the traditional suburbs. The suburbs themselves are changing. It's this kind of instant urbanism in many respects. In many times, it does reflect more, I think, the values of powerful developers than the seemingly democratic collective actions over time of so many individuals that give incremental urbanism a more authentic link to past and future generations. But it raises some interesting questions. As we see these changes, I think the scale of projects becomes really interesting. I deliberately showed a lot of these different scales. We're seeing, in general, it seems to take the bigger projects to start the trigger effects. When I first started this research, I just was pretty convinced that actually the strip malls, which seemed like the easy fruit, were just never going to happen because they're too small a parcel size. Now, I'm starting to see strip malls changing over, but only if there's been a larger property transformation within about a 2-mile radius. The transitions are not, within urbanism, we've seen these kinds of sequential images that sort of show, if you start with this condition, and then somebody builds, one project, then the next one will flip, and then the next one will flip, and somehow it's like this seamless transformation. We're not seeing it being anywhere near as seamless as that, but we are seeing those kinds of trigger effects. I think the trigger effects can also, so they're often happening through a big project. They're often happening through, sometimes the trigger is transit. Sometimes it is incentives that are being put forward by a community, by their own zoning and rules, especially transformations along the corridor, rezonings that suddenly start to allow for higher density along corridors. That's definitely working. There's some interesting, that is the last slide. I think there are, we're hoping that all of this, I think, becomes certainly much more sustainable. Whether we're really at the point where these retrofits are, is this sustainable urbanism, or is it just a little more sustainable than sort of current conventional model? I tend to think at this point that if your larger regional context is still auto-dependent, your new development is still going to be very much auto-dependent. It's whether we're at least allowing for a lot more choices and whether we're starting to plan ahead and think about the regional patterns, can we start to find ways to better link up these dots and I think do some more things. So I think there's still a lot of as many questions to be raised by all of this, but it's time for me to stop and turn it over to the question of what really is sustainable urbanism is what Susan and Doug are going to be talking about next.